is The Fall Line. This podcast, and everything, really, that we've done with it, begins with one event. The disappearance of Jeanette and Danette Millbrook, fraternal twins who, on March 18, 1990, left a convenience store in Augusta, Georgia, on foot. They were headed to their mother's house just a few miles away, but they never made it. Through our work on this case, a case closed for over 20 years, from 1991 until 2013, we have made many friends and allies. One person in particular has been a strong presence in both our work and in supporting the family of the twins. She makes sure the twin sister Shantae and their mother Miss Louise get coverage each time anything changes in the case or an anniversary comes up. In fact, she's been there with us since the beginning, working on the other side of the media line in more traditional news. We met Renetta DeBose, anchor and reporter for Augusta Aiken's WJBF, 4 years ago, and from the start, it was clear we were all interested in the same things: investigating cold cases and attracting attention to the most forgotten murders and disappearances. Renetta has stuck with Danette and Jeanette's case, but they aren't the only missing or murdered people in Augusta or in Aiken. And as Renetta has built her career in the Augusta-Aiken area, she's become known as the television news reporter to dig into and stay with the area's coldest cases. And she's likely the perfect person for that job, because she's not just an investigative journalist. She's also the family member of a murder victim whose case has gone cold. Her own grandmother, Gwendolyn, was killed in Indiana, and the family has been waiting for answers since Renetta was a small child. She's grown up with the unfinished business and the pain of her grandmother's case and absence permeating her family. As long as we've known Renetta, she's been busy, never a woman to sit idle. She's on so many committees and boards that she often has a meeting every night in a given week. She's a member of the Augusta Alumni Chapter of Delta Sigma Theta Sorority, Incorporated, and on the Positively Augusta HIV AIDS and Awareness Board, a member of the Augusta Chapter of the Lynx, Incorporated, and a member of the Patient Advisory Board of the PCOS Challenge, the National Polycystic Ovary Syndrome Association. And that's just her regular rotation. But earlier this year, Renetta made time for another really fascinating project, one that isn't seen often in broadcast news, where reporters are so often limited to two-minute segments: a monthly deep dive special series called The Cold Case Project. In it, she covers the cases of the missing and murdered of South Carolina and Georgia, and works with families and law enforcement to get their cases back in the spotlight. We sat down with Renetta in early October to discuss this work and her own story, which makes her uniquely qualified to work with families of the missing and the murdered. How long have you been working in journalism, and have you always been interested in investigative journalism?
I have been working in journalism for about 15 years, and I am at my fourth station now. And I started working on investigative journalism sort of right away, in some capacity. But really, it was probably when I worked for a PBS affiliate in the Chicago market where I really started looking deeply into stories, the reason for them. And I've been doing that probably for the past, 8 or 9 years or so. I made the move sight unseen to Augusta, Georgia, with the hope of reporting on stories, having anchor opportunities, and digging deeper in the stories. It was part of my interview that I wouldn't just report on who committed the crime or who police was looking for, but sort of the why behind it. So I came with that long-form inquisitive mind that had already started to be developed at my PBS station and in my prior career.
And that speaks to my personal experience with you, that you've always had that special focus on crime and the effect it has on people, and especially on families. And I know that has, at least in some part, to do with your own family and the murder of your grandmother. Can you talk to us a little bit about your grandmother, Gwen?
My grandmother, Gwendolyn Phyllis Broughton Larry, was someone that I never remembered because she was killed when I was just a baby. She was killed on October 30th, 1984 in Gary, Indiana. She was coming home from a friend's home in the middle of the night. And when she parked her car and began to get out of her car, someone came up behind her and shot her in the head. Now, she did carry a weapon with her, and she was able to discharge her weapon in the process of someone walking up on her. And that person left the state of Indiana and fled to Michigan, from what we have been told, had the bullet removed. And that's all we know. We found out from the streets talking that someone talked to that individual, and as he was looking for a way out of town. And it's just sort of been that story until I became a reporter in my hometown. And in 2012, I reopened the case with the Gary Police Department and was not able to get anywhere with it. So her case is still considered cold. Early on, the FBI was looking into it, but not much came of that. And so this murder of my grandmother has been a stain on our family and on my life, my entire life. It's hard as a child, and you ask a lot of questions, but you don't always get a lot of answers. And I heard so much about how my father wanted to name me after her and how much I'm like her, but I never had an opportunity to make a photo with her or get to know her or have her come to my school for Grandparents' Day, you know, or grow up with that grandparent and see, you know, what she thought about me in school and playing sports and getting into the television career. And so her children lost her. She was taken from them, and they were all so very young. And it just, I can see how it's impacted each of them differently, even until today. And outside of an older cousin and myself, she didn't get a chance to meet the rest of her grandkids. We just feel robbed. And we know that people know who did it, and they just won't talk. And it's very frustrating. So I use that story, that part of my life, to empathize with families when I cover murder cases and even missing person cases.
How much were you able to find out about that initial investigation that was done when you readdressed the case in 2012?
I reopened the case because I was covering crime almost every day in Gary, Indiana, which is my hometown. And so I was always talking with investigators, with the very police department that was responsible for investigating my grandmother's murder. And so I say, you know what? I'm investigating all of these other crimes. What about my own? And so my own family's saga. And so the only thing I knew at that point was there was a newspaper article that ran that morning. She was killed overnight. So there was an article in the Gary Post Tribune newspaper that morning. And it was a very short article. I don't even believe it was front page. If it was, it was just a couple inches. And it talked about how she was killed. And I believe that same article mentioned that the FBI was being called in to help. And so when I spoke with the homicide detective at that time, he had very little information. Most of the information was rehashed by me, which was secondhand information. And then investigators had me bring in all three of her children into the police station, and they re-interviewed them. So my mother, her brother, and sister were all interviewed because they all ended up at the crime scene in Gary that day. I know my aunt was about 3 hours away at college and ended up back home. But everyone was also involved in hearing information around the community. So they took those interviews again, because of course they interviewed the family that day. The only interview that was real, that my mother really remembered, was the police focused heavily on my grandfather, her husband. And that upset the family a lot. but he was taken in that day and interviewed. But in 2012, because my grandfather is deceased, they interviewed the children more and talked with me, and I gave them everything that I knew. You know, it almost takes you working with law enforcement on your loved one's case, sharing as much information as you know, even if it seems like a rumor in the community, you share that. As the investigation went along, I had community help. Someone created a nice flyer. We put the police department's phone number on it, and we got it out into the community. But it took a lot of legwork from me. And I remember having the detective go to a public event that I knew one of the witnesses was going to be at. Now, he didn't tell the truth when he showed up, but that's how hands-on I was with the investigation when it reopened.
It's really interesting that you're talking about all of these factors I think people who haven't dealt with this are aware of. When you're dealing with a really cold case, you have to be so proactive and you have to kind of go out and find leads. That brings up what you're working on now, which is your cold case project in Augusta and Aiken, and the kind of hands-on work that families have to do. Can you talk about cold case project and how you developed that?
After covering several murdered and missing cases for my television station, my boss said, "Hey, I want you to do more cold cases." And at first I was hesitant because it would require me to step away from daily reporting. But I spoke it over with, you know, my family and coworkers, and it sounded like a good opportunity to tell those unheard of stories of families. So I came up with Cold Case Project. And I decided to choose one family's case a month and rotate counties and states. Since we cover South Carolina and Georgia, I wanted to make sure that I had a nice mix of both areas. I appealed to the community and I simply asked, what story should Cold Case Project cover? And I received an overwhelming response from the community. It was amazing how many people needed their loved ones, friends, and people's story told, how many people needed someone to just go to law enforcement and help them or just put their loved one's story on television. So I started in March, and it was right around the anniversary of the Millbrook twins, who have been missing for over 30 years now from Augusta, Georgia.
I would love for you to tell us a little bit about each of the cases that you covered. But first, I'd love for you to speak a little bit about what you're hoping to accomplish with your spotlight. Because, of course, the obvious answer is get these folks' cases back on television. But I feel like you're doing more.
My goal with Cold Case Project, I want justice for these families. I want closure. I want to see someone get put away for these crimes. And if they're no longer here, I want it closed. If someone's missing, I want them home. My goal is to shape the person outside of name, age, location of death, and manner of death. So I talk about how they grew up, what their mother felt like when they were born, what their father felt like raising them, what their siblings felt like growing up with them. If their parents, you know, what their children loved about them, what they loved to eat, what they loved to watch, what they did. I humanize them because we don't always have an opportunity to do that on a 1.5 minute story or less in television news. We tell you the location, maybe a name, and what happened, and we move on. But Cold Case Project has an opportunity to show you their photo. You know, last month I had an opportunity to let people hear the voice of the person who was missing. And you are drawn into their life so that you think, this can be my loved one. This could be my husband, my mother, my sister, my niece. This could be them. So I think I'm gonna say what I know, because people fear law enforcement. They fear getting in trouble when they get involved in this. They fear retaliation. And I want to humanize this person so much that by the end of the story, you're crying and you're talking. And this case is getting closed.
Our listeners are very familiar with the Millbrook twins, but could you tell us a little bit about each of the other cases you've covered so far?
After I kicked off the Cold Case Project with the Millbrook twins, I moved on to another state. And in April, I covered Reverend Jim Ivey. And he was a businessman, a former pastor, a father, a grandfather. And Reverend Ivey was in his store. He had a used furniture store in Aiken. And someone came in and attacked him and killed him. And his daughter, who's around the same age as he was when he was killed in 1998, spoke along with his grandsons. And it's just like, who would want to kill an upstanding businessman who was a pastor? So we put his story out there with his photos of his family. And, you know, it was just so amazing to be able to share that story and get that out to the public. Cold Case Project moved on to Edgefield County on the Georgia side in May, and we did a story on Larry Sanders Jr. And Larry Sanders Jr. was killed in his home. So he was actually in his home with his girlfriend at the time, and someone came into the back door and shot up his bedroom door, and he was shot during that incident and he died. And so when police came in, they found his girlfriend, you know, covered in his blood. And she was never considered a suspect in the case. It's a cold case. They do believe that it is drug related. And so that's one piece that was a touchy subject, because I wasn't quite sure if the mother knew that bit of information. So it took a lot of me talking with the mom, you know, making sure that she knew that information. And it was a little bit more than just telling his story. So, of course, I shared that he has two beautiful little girls, you know, a mother and a brother who loves him, and about how he grew up. And I showed all of his photos when he was a kid. People write people off like that. But someone who is a father, who is loved, someone who had an opportunity to take his young girls out on, you know, a trip, but didn't get a chance to see them in school and win awards and do athletics. They were robbed of their father for whatever reason. So please share information about him. Larry Sanders Jr. case was more than just getting the information out there, but I actually spent a great deal of time connecting his mother with law enforcement. So she hadn't heard from law enforcement for years, and she had reached out to no avail. And I actually went to the sheriff's office with her. We just made a surprise visit and walked in and sat down and spoke with him. And her other son went too. And I encouraged her to write letters to the state law enforcement department, SLED, and in South Carolina. And that was something that she hadn't thought to do, but I encouraged her. I look at my opportunity to tell stories on the murdered and the missing, not to just regurgitate information back to the community, not to just be, you know, appealing in my reports, but I also consider myself, you know, an activist as well. And so I use the resources that I have been afforded as a journalist, and I share them with the families. In June, Cold Case Project went out to McDuffie County and reported on the shooting death of Jonathan Gurley. His family and friends want justice. When I tell you they are on it, they are on it. I believe it was April, they had a walk through McDuffie County from the courthouse to the cemetery where Mr. Gurley's buried. And we joined them that day. And also who showed up was the district attorney for that area. And you don't always see that. That was very impressive. But this is how hard this family has been working on getting this case solved. They have buy-in now from the district attorney's office. He showed up to this march. He spoke on camera. And the district attorney, our cameras in the community, marched through the streets of Thompson with posters and pictures demanding justice all the way to the cemetery. Folks had on t-shirts and everything. And a little bit of information about this case, Mr. Gurley had gone to pick up his check. It was around the holiday time, and he had gone home. He was about to Christmas shop and do some fun things with his family. And they had just gotten back from him getting his check and them going to the store when he was killed. And the family, the way the family describes it, they believe that someone was waiting for him at his home, hiding behind his trailer, so that when he arrived home, they in his truck, they came out of from behind his trailer and shot him multiple times and killed him. At the time, his significant other and his child were in the home, and Mr. Gurley mustered up the strength to crawl to his door and knock on the door, and they tried to revive him on the scene, but he didn't make it by the time he reached the hospital in McDuffie County. The motive is still out there being investigated, but we did a lot of looking into the possibilities, what could have happened. This family has a very active memorial page for Jonathan Gurley. They're constantly talking about the case, about him, and I believe that they'll get justice one day. That's because the district attorney feels like they will get justice one day. Now, in July, Cold Case Project went to the city of Aiken. When I first launched Cold Case Project, Aiken Public Safety got a hold of me and they said, whatever you need from us, we'll help you out. We have a couple of cases we think you'd be interested in. Come talk to us. And that was so refreshing. I didn't have to beat their doors down. They laid it out for me and there were no cameras. We just spoke and they said, well, here are some cases that we think would be good. And so I said, well, which one do you think we should do first? And they picked Moses Williams Jr. What really drew me to this particular case was Moses Williams Jr.'s family. There were so many people when we arrived at the interview. I made one phone call to his mother and 20 relatives showed up to the interview. They were so, so passionate. I have learned so much about Moses, how, you know, he was sort of the apple of his parents and grandparents and aunt and uncle's lives and eyes, how he loved football. He played for two different schools in South Carolina and was good. And he had just had a son. I don't even know if his son was over the age of one when he was killed, but it was Super Bowl Sunday. And he had been talking with his family. He had been with a relative watching the Super Bowl, and he had his girlfriend and her sister with him. He went to drop them off. And while he was dropping off his girlfriend and her sister in Han Village in Aiken, which is a troubled neighborhood, so much so that it has been condemned, shut down, and is being torn down as we speak. But someone came up to his vehicle and shot him and killed him. And his girlfriend turned around and her sister, and they drove him to the hospital. They heard the shot, and because it was literally just a few feet from their front door, and he died when he got to the hospital. And what's interesting is his mom and his uncle and aunt were just a few blocks away, so close that they heard the shot too, and it didn't register until they got a phone call saying, they called him Fat Man. Fat Man's been shot. And the mom says she just took off running. She's just running in the street. They saw the car leaving Han Village to head to the hospital. They go and they get to the hospital and find out he's deceased. The law enforcement folks who shared his case shared it because they said, we believe that there are eyewitnesses in the case who will say something or who can say something to close the case. In August, Cold Case Project moved back to Georgia and we went to Burke County. Sheriff Alfonso Williams in Burke County has closed all of his homicides. None of them are open. So we actually had to choose from cases that happened under the prior sheriff's administration. They chose a 25-year-old named Daniel Triplett, who was killed just before Christmas in 2016. And Daniel Triplett's case is interesting because he was killed after leaving his significant other's home and going to visit maybe a relative, maybe a friend at an apartment complex. But then his body was somewhere else. So in this case, you have to understand, okay, was he killed somewhere and moved somewhere else? And what does that mean? And how did he end up on a dirt road in the middle of the country? His family members were praying and hoping for justice. But here's the sad and unfortunate part that so many families don't realize is happening. When I spoke with the investigator, and this investigator had just been assigned Daniel Triplett's case when I called about it. So I asked the investigator, I said, what made you pick up this case? And he said, Well, you called about it. So we went and got it from the GBI. So I said, well, can you look in the file and tell me the last time the GBI investigated this case? Daniel Tripa died in around Christmas 2016. The last thing GBI noted in the case was in February of 2017, mm-hmm. 2 months later. So that means that during all of the years from 2016, the end of 2016 until 2021, August of 2021, his mother was praying, hoping for justice. His loved ones, his friends, everybody's praying for justice. And this case is sitting on a shelf at the GBI untouched. And so we were able to talk about how he was such a smart kid and how he played football, graduated from Burke County High School, and how he was working on a trade and talked about his children. And we even talked to the mother of his children and were able to show their photos and how she has to talk to them about who their father was because they were so young. But it's so sad because nobody was really investigating. It was sitting on a shelf. September took us to Jefferson County, Georgia, where we did a story on Bill Bo Peep Farah. And when I tell you this family of Mr. Fair is the epitome of loved ones who are looking for justice. They are the epitome. I was first given this story by a coworker who is from the area, and he said, people are still talking about this case. Mr. Fair went fishing September 13, 2002. He went fishing at Rocky Comfort Creek in Jefferson County and was never seen again, disappeared. A lot of family members and friends believe he met foul play, but a lot of people thought he drowned at Rocky Comfort Creek, which is interesting because we learned that standing up, the creek only hits you kind of about at the waist. So he would have had to hit his head and fall in. But even if he did that, the response was so amazing. Divers, and they even had dogs come and search the area. They had 100 volunteers search. Men got into that creek, held hands, and walked through it and still didn't find them. But here's the most impressive thing. That creek was drained. The entire creek was drained, and there was no body. He did not drown. His loved ones, he has several siblings. They never believed he drowned because they said he swam in the river as a kid. He was a strong swimmer. So how could he have drowned? They thought he drowned, and law enforcement spent all of its resources and efforts looking for a man who drowned. And when they drained the creek, it was like, he is not here. Then they thought he must have run off to start a new life. But nothing in his financial records indicated that. He hasn't touched a thing. He didn't even draw Social Security, and he could have. And so the other thought was, he met foul play. And there were some interesting things. We had the opportunity to talk about how a few months before he went missing, how he went to the sheriff's office to report that he was attacked by two men that he believed drove in from North Carolina. And we actually had the opportunity to hear him talk to the investigator. So we, most times it's someone who was killed and we have photos. But we had an opportunity to share his voice on our airwaves. And that was just so intriguing to me. The family got a tape of his interview with the investigator explaining how two men attacked him. You know, they put a stun gun on him and he feared for his life. He had to run in that wooded creek area and hide in the woods until nightfall, until they left. And he feared for his life in his last days. And so nobody thought in his life, the people who loved him, nobody thought he drowned. They certainly thought he had met foul play because right before, a couple of years maybe before he was attacked, he found in that creek area, that Rocky Comfort Creek area, what he thought was a marijuana patch. Now, of course, you have people all over now growing medical marijuana, and, you know, in certain places it's legal. But we're talking about in late 90s, early 2000s, you know, this was still like, this is illegal. This is, you know, it's still illegal, but this, it was just, you know, a taboo thing. He's going around talking about how he sees a marijuana patch that looks like it has military-style netting on it, and his family really believes that he saw something he was not supposed to see that led to him being attacked, that led to him meeting foul play. In October, Cold Case Project is going back to Edgefield County, Georgia, and we are doing a story on a woman that many people may have heard of before. Her name is Tammy Kingery, and on September 20th, 2014, she left work not feeling well. Her husband picked her up from work, and she went home, and her husband left, and she wrote a letter, apparently, saying that she was going for a walk, be back soon, love you, and was never seen again. And so this case is so interesting because it's not normal for her to walk around her home. There are a lot of woods near her home, and the street that's nearby has no sidewalks. There are ditches. So it's not really a place where you would walk. And in fact, when she did go on walks, she would go to a nearby trail. She also didn't write letters. She texted a lot. So that was interesting. Although several years later, law enforcement sort of verified that it was her handwriting, although family members don't agree. But it's like she just disappeared.
This is kind of a big question, but I bet you'll have an answer. Do you think there are any distinct or unifying factors that cause these cases to go cold? Is there something you're able to pick out in each case and say, you know, this is the thing that causes cases to go cold?
The cases seem to go cold because there are no strong leads that can lead investigators to an arrest and ultimately a conviction. Because, and I tell families this all the time, law enforcement has to have a strong enough case that a prosecutor can pick up, take to court, and get a conviction. You only have one shot at this. I remember speaking to the district attorney in the Jonathan Gurley case, and he felt confident, but he was still investigating because he wanted to win this case. You know, you only get one shot. You only get one try to bring this case before, you know, a jury of its peers and get a conviction. And so if you don't have sufficient evidence or a strong enough case, then that's it. And so people don't understand that, though. They just want to take one piece of information and get somebody arrested and see them go away for a long time. But it truly takes, you know, those involved having a comprehensive case that can really nail this person for a long time or forever.
Have you found that working on Cold Case Project has been a positive experience for you and for the families in terms of healing?
I feel like every time I sit down with a family, it's always the best thing ever. The realness of it all and the transparency of it all is so important. I hear a lot of families say, it's so easy to talk to you because I don't read questions from a notepad. I'm just sitting there having a conversation. And I recently interviewed a family just this week, and the mother said, we've done other stories with other reporters, but you seem like you care. And I don't know where she got that from, but I said, you know what? Because I do.
So while we have you on the line, I wanted to ask your opinion on something which is related. And this is something we've been talking about amongst ourselves. There's been a lot of focus in the last month or so on who does and doesn't get media coverage. And that's something we talk about on our show anyway. Specifically, discussion around Gabby Petito's disappearance and later her murder. And one thing we've been talking about is the confluence of factors. Not just that she's blonde and white and young, but also the accessibility of her social media accounts, the available body cam footage, the way the public was able to crowd insert themselves into her case, that all of that seems to have added up into the huge push in media coverage. But what else is there, in your opinion, that might get a case more media attention and staying power and another case less media attention and staying power?
So I've thought a lot about the Gabby Petito case and why it's being covered so heavily. Initially, the question I asked myself was, who is she and why is she getting this coverage? And yes, it's an interesting case when you have a woman going cross country with her boyfriend and he returns and she doesn't. I mean, that's just, it's different. I've thought about this, and it's not just Gabby Petito, but it's age old, right? We've seen it in the past, decades ago, with cases like JonBenet Ramsey. And so what I have come to learn as a journalist is you have to have people of diverse backgrounds, not just in a newsroom, but in management positions in a newsroom. So if you have a majority white newsroom, you just don't know how to appeal to those communities, or you don't have anyone looking out for those communities or speaking up for those communities. So if you don't have African-Americans, Asians, Hispanics, you know, people in the LGBT community or allies talking about these cases in your newsrooms, then you won't, and making management decisions where you cover those cases, then you won't. And I'll share a story just in my own newsroom. I remember a case that was heavily covered internationally, the Janelle Carwell case. I had been on vacation, come back, and questioned in my morning editorial meeting why we were not covering this case on this African-American 16-year-old who went missing with her stepfather. I'm like, come on, this is a Lifetime movie. Why aren't we covering this? And it was like, okay, well, fine, you can do it. But had I not been the Black woman in this newsroom who was looking at this 16-year-old like, this could be my niece, it wouldn't have been covered. And I can say that wholeheartedly. Another case that I covered exactly 1 year ago was about a trans person who was left dead in a park. And I had a coworker say to me, why do we need to cover another Richmond County death? People die there all the time. And it hurt my soul. This case had been picked up by national human rights organizations because we keep having trans people die and be killed. So you have these newsrooms that are staffed with, you know, people who aren't, you know, minorities, and they don't care. I can honestly say they don't care, or they aren't aware, you know? So it's important to have diversity in the newsroom.
Have you found this to be true no matter what the demographics of a city are?
Absolutely. So you may have some of your larger cities with a little more staff of color and staff who are diverse. But when it comes to management, even in large cities, it's the same thing. The same thing.
What can the public and journalists do together to get more cases and more diverse cases in the spotlight with more consistency and with more representation?
I think it's important for anyone working as a journalist to know where you are. So I always tell people whenever I start a new job, I am going to join the local church. I'm going to join my local chapter for my sorority. In any other organization where I feel I can really jump in and learn about the community and learn the heartbeat of the community, you have to know where you are. You have to know the people, and not just know of them, but know them. And I always tell new reporters, you can't go home every weekend. Be a part of the community. Grocery shop there, join organizations, and let people know you and get to know them so that you can know what people want to talk about. And then once you learn that information, Then find something that you're good at. Find something that you know will be a unique and different contribution to the viewers, and advocate for it and do it. You know, I have one coworker who was a victim of domestic violence, and so that's her thing. She took a story. Actually, I didn't even realize a story that I covered last year where a woman was held hostage in her home. And she dug deeper and found out she was a victim of domestic violence. And she's turning it into a 3-part series this month for Domestic Violence Awareness Month. Find out what it is that you love and do it. And you do have to sell it to management. Sell it and tell them why this is something important, why this is something that people need to hear. And don't be afraid to do it and do something different so that you can try to change the community that you're in.
For listeners who are not in the South Carolina, Georgia area, Can you tell them where they can go watch some of your stories and read about them?
Cold Case Project has a home on WJBF.com. There's a tab called Cold Cases, and we have all the cold cases that we have reported on. And we also have related stories as well. So if it's a cold case, if it's suspicious, you know, remains were found somewhere, you know, we'll put it there too. If you subscribe to us on YouTube, Cold Case is there. And you can also find it on the WJBF social media pages, as well as the Rena Tadubo's WJBF social media pages as well.
Please be sure to check out Cold Case Project. There's a link in our show notes. Renetta is doing in-depth reporting on little-known cases in the Southeast, and those stories need sharing. Thank you for listening. The Fall Line is a fully independent show, and we appreciate listener support. It allows us to do research, obtain FOIA, pay our content advisors, and support and donate to the causes we care about. If you try out the products we advertise, please use our sponsor codes. It really helps. And if you'd like to support the show and the stories we cover, join us on Patreon. We're raising Patreon funds to continue to pay for the Milberg Twins billboard and to grow our therapy fund for families who've been on the show. Recently, we've been able to fund a year of therapy for two people, and we want to expand that. Each and every one of our patrons helps us continue this work, and we're so grateful for your help. On Patreon, you can get early release, ad-free versions of our regular episodes, plus blogs and videos for only $5 a month. We've also added live streams, which all patrons can enjoy, starting at just a dollar. The Fall Line is written, hosted, and researched by Laura Norton, with additional research by Brian Waters and Kim Fritz, family interviews by Brooke Hargrove, produced, engineered, and scored by Maura Curry. Content advisement by Brandy C. Williams, Liv Fallon, and Vic Kennedy. And, as always, our most special thanks to Angie Dodd. Currently, our monthly donation is going to Private Investigations for the Missing. Please join us in supporting this nonprofit. They need funds to help families access the service of private investigators.